for the House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for the 92nd State Legislative Session will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Lee Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleborn.
Cleborn, present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller, present.
Representative Novotny.
Body, present.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Present.
Representative Vang. Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Chung.
Present.
And that concludes roll call, Chair. A quorum is present.
Very well, a quorum is present. Members, this hearing is being conducted as a hybrid meeting. I guess that's the terminology. Most of us on the committee are physically in the room, but we do have members that are present virtually, as well as individuals from the public that will be offering testimony. Again, both physically present, but also out in virtual space. And so that's being conducted under Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing for hearings to be held via use of distance voting, remote electronic voting, or voting by other means to protect the health and safety of the public, staff, and members. The hearing is being live streamed on the Minnesota House website and the committee page. Those wishing to offer public testimony can contact our committee administrator today to just wave at him, Jamel Lundy. And we ask for testifiers to do that 24 hours prior to our hearing, and his email address is available on our page. Before we start, Lee Johnson would like to say a few words. And so, Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I want to thank you for having the in-person meetings this week. It is really important because these are important issues that we're dealing with involving all, not just the metro area, but in the entire state. And for the members here, there's a number of new members that have never sat in a committee meeting. Welcome. You're going to finally see how these committee meetings actually work, be involved in it. And hopefully we can have a good meeting today. And again, thank you for having meetings in person.
Thank you, Lee Johnson. Thank you for pressing me to do that and reminding me that it's an important thing for us to do. We will be having three hearings this week. This one, Thursday and Friday, we'll use the same format. The Thursday and Friday meetings will be longer than the usual time. And the reason for that is that it's my intent that we move an omnibus bill out by this Friday. And so we're going to today walk through a DE that the chair has put together, and we'll take testimony on that, and hopefully we'll also have a good discussion among ourselves. On Thursday, we'll begin the markup process and taking up amendments, debating those. We've been allocated 4 hours of time to do that on Thursday. And then 4 hours, or a little bit more than 4 hours on Friday morning as well. It'll be my intention to be here, and hopefully all members can be here, but if you're not, we will be able to conduct this in a hybrid manner. Trying to think what else I want to... The amendments will be due by 2 p.m. Tomorrow. We'll be following an amendment to amendments process, so those amendments will be due by 7 p.m. Tomorrow. If you're running into any snags with that, let us know as soon as possible. With that, our first item, we actually do have an item of business we'll vote on today, which will be the minutes of March 31st and April 1st. And Lee Johnson, I'm wondering if maybe Representative Rowley, who's not been in the committee hearing physically before, would be so kind as to move the minutes of March 31st.
Mr. Chair, I've read, and I would like to move those minutes.
Very well. The motion is before us. Discussion. Lee Johnson? We're good for
a... We're good.
All right.
Voice vote is fine.
Very well. All in favor of adoption of the March 31st and April 1st minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and I get to use this thing for the first time in the last 2 years. And the minutes of March 31st and April 1st are hereby adopted. That kind of felt good. I've been using a coffee mug at home, a big stout coffee mug, and it says Papa on it. So it's definitely authoritative. members, the chair will move House File 4608 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. That will serve as the bill for our omnibus, committee omnibus bill. And I do have an author's, and so that bill is before us. I do have an author's amendment, a DE amendment, and so the chair moves adoption of the DE2 amendment. Those should all be in your packets. Lee Johnson, I think customer usage, we just do a voice vote on adopting those. That. Very well. All in favor of adopting the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And House File 4608 is amended before us. Members, what I will be doing is having our staff walk through, our nonpartisan House staff walk through the DE2. And I'm hoping they won't do it super fast, but I also am hoping that they'll be very efficient in doing it so that we can get into the testimony. I'll just say very quickly that the author and the chair's intent with this is really to drive four or five big concepts. One is to drive, in my estimation, an approach to public safety that's innovative in its nature. In other words, I'm less interested in kind of doing the same old, and to really be about doing new things and trying to put into place the mechanisms in our state government that can continue to build on innovation. The three components of that particular part has to do with helping to build up capacity within our conventional law enforcement practices and communities and entities, as well as building up capacity for community-based public safety intervention and prevention, particularly around violence intervention, and then addressing accountability issues in both of those spheres. My intent is, my hope is that we can be drive an effective response to the crime problems that we currently face. The other three elements have to do with driving similar innovative approaches relative to youth, juvenile justice issues. Doing the same in terms of finding effective, restorative ways to for the state to be present with those who are victims of crime, survivors of crime. And then the fourth major area having to do with county-based and state, but county-based community supervision and probation services. We'll talk more about that later, but again, really looking to drive good innovations that's evidence-based so that we can powerfully put the exclamation point on corrections in our corrections system. There are a number of other critical components with the bill. We'll hear about those as we go through, particularly around emergency management issues. And so with that, members, I'll stop.
Thank you.
We just did. Very well. With that, I'm going to ask our nonpartisan staff to come forward and walk us through the DE2. So that's Mr. Johnson and Mr. Debo, and I think perhaps Mr. Walsh as well. And I suspect they're with us virtually. Is that the... Very well.
Mr. Chair, this is John Walsh from House Fiscal Staff. Would you like me to share screen?
Please, thank you.
Mr. Chair, before you is the spreadsheet. The governor's recommendations are in the shaded column, and the House recommendations are on the far right. I'll begin in the Department of Public Safety in Homeland Security and Emergency Management. We included the governor's request for first responder wellness office at $2 million in the first year. Not included is the local government emergency management grants on a one-time basis. We do, however, have those on line 10 at $1.5 million with ongoing funding. On line 9, the mutual aid response training at $500,000 was included. And also on line 11, supplemental security grants were included for $225,000 on a one-time basis. The DE does not include the governor's request for alcohol and gambling enforcement additional positions, nor the state fire marshal bomb squad deficiency. But on line 26, in the emergency communication networks, we have on a one-time basis $1 million for portable public safety radio grants, and these would be grants to local communities for the purchase of mobile radios. Moving down to line 29, we begin the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. We have funded a portion of the Violent Crime Reduction Support Initiative at $1.5 million a year ongoing. The DE does not include the simulator trailers, but it does include the cybersecurity upgrades on line 33 for $2.4 million, with $9 million per year entails. And it does include the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement at $186,000. Also included to the BCA is funding for House File 1355. This would be for additional testing for changes in marijuana penalties. On line 36, there's also funding for the Clean Slate Act. This would be for some data collection, and this is $1,100,000 in this biennium, $520,000 in fiscal 24. And at that point, there would be no additional funding. It's one time for that purpose. On line 40, we begin the Office of Justice Programs. The governor had requested some additional funding for expanding the workforce in Office of Justice Programs. House File 4200 had included several more personnel, and so the funding you see represented on line 42 falls somewhere in between and provides $3.6 million of ongoing funding for additional personnel. On line 43, we have some funding, $5 million in fiscal 23 for domestic violence and sexual assault intervention. On line 44, there is the inclusion of $500,000 for youth development grants on a ongoing basis. On line 47, we have general crime and trauma recovery funding at $1 million per year. We have dual status youth model grants for $1 million a year ongoing. The House, the governor had suggested $1 million a year from the general fund. We have included $1 million per year, but it is coming from a newly created special revenue fund. Moving down to line 52, community-based public safety grants. The DE includes $1.78 million in fiscal 23 and $565,000 in ongoing funding. The governor had requested funding for four additional juvenile detention conflict resolution centers. The DE includes funding for two new centers at $1.4 million per year. The DE also includes $1 million a year for additional Minnesota HEALS funding, and that includes funding for equine therapy. Mr. Chair, moving down to line 57, we've also included $25,000 a year for the prosecutor training fund, which brings us down to additional member bills on line 58. There is the inclusion of House File 861, Direct Assistance to Crime Victims, $4 million in this biennium and $2 million a year ongoing funding. On line 59, additional combating sex trafficking grants, that is $1.5 million addition per year in ongoing funding. On line 60, we have $1 million a year for EpiPens for local law enforcement grants. On line 61, we have the Office of Missing and Murdered Black Girls and Women for $500,000 per year. On line 62, an Indigenous Investigation Reward Fund of $110,000 per year. On line 63, Youth Intervention Grants, $1 million addition one time in this biennium. On line 64, a Substance Abuse Task Force at roughly $150,000 a year. We have Youth Justice Grants, a prevention category. The total funding is $1.75 million, with $1.6 coming from the newly created Special Revenue Fund and $150,000 in general fund. All of that is ongoing money. We have Youth Justice Grants Intervention, $2.5 million per year in ongoing funding on line 67. And on line 68, Youth Wellness Support and Mental Health, $1.75 million per year in ongoing funding. We have a Juvenile Wellness and Justice Task Force at $150,000 one time on line 69. On line 70, we have from House File 4200 co-responder grants, $10 million a year ongoing funding. On line 71, local community intervention grants. This would be $55 million in fiscal 2023. And $30 million in ongoing funding. For emergency communities public safety grants, we have $15 million available immediately on line 72. And on line 73, local community policing grants, $15 million in 2023 and $10 million ongoing. And local investigation grants, $15 million in 2023 and $10 million ongoing. All those provisions would be from House File 4200. That takes us down to the State Patrol. They have costs from the fiscal note on line 82 from House File 1355. These would be the marijuana penalties modified, $168,000 a year, and costs related to the Clean Slate Act, $84,000 in fiscal 23 and $168,000 ongoing. Those expenses were both from the Trunk Highway Fund. Moving down on line 87 to administrative services with the within the Department of Public Safety, we have from House File 4200 body camera storage grants at a little over $6 million a year ongoing. On line 90, body camera, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, on line 89, that's data storage. On line 90, body camera grants, $9 million in fiscal 23 and $4.5 million a year ongoing. And on line 91, House File 2867, soft body armor grants at $1 million a year ongoing. Mr. Chair, that would add $166 million this year in the Department of, for this biennium in the Department of Public Safety. Moving down to line 100, the Post Board, we have included the governor's request for database for public records, $165,000 available in fiscal 22, and also a cost related to House File 4200, Alternative Courses Task Force, $50,000 one time. House File 3785 on line 106, Strength and Agility Standards, $250,000 a year ongoing. And also on line 107, House File 4200, investigation staffing, $1.25 million a year ongoing. Moving on to the Private Detectives and Protective Agents Board, we have the governor's request for records management system and background check, and background checks, $98,000 in this biennium and $18,000 a year ongoing. We have additional staffing to investigate complaints and conduct field audits. That is $430,000 a year. And on line 20, an annual review of training curriculum at $70,000 per year. That brings us down to the Department of Corrections and Incarceration and Pre-Release Services. We included governor's requests for family support at $280,000 per year, maintaining family connections at $1.5 million per year. Post-secondary education and employment would be $2 million in fiscal 23, with an increase in tails of $3.5 million per year ongoing, and body-worn cameras for Department of Corrections staff, $1.5 million in 23 and $1 million ongoing thereafter. We did not include the funding of the governor's request for interstate transport reimbursement to counties, but on lines 134, 135, and 136, we have changes to bed impacts related to House File 2734, qualified domestic orders, House File 4174, aiding and abetting felony murder, and House File 1355, marijuana penalties modified. Mr. Chair, moving down to line 142, community supervision and post-release. Included in the DE is an increase for county grants. This was a hybrid of the governor's proposal. We delay the phase-in by 1 year and include $5.9 million in increased funding to counties in fiscal 2023, and then $26 million in fiscal 24, and 38.8 in fiscal 25. Also included is the Healing House Model Project at $150,000 per year on line 144, and the expansion of work release programs on line 145 at $1 million per year, and that is ongoing funding. On line 51, beginning in administrative services, the funding for the governor's request of public safety data infrastructure is fully funded on line 152, $12 million in this biennium and $17 million in ongoing funding in the tails. On line 153, $230,000 a year for project management. On line 154, increased premiums for property insurance, $650,000 a year ongoing. And on line 155, the indeterminate sentence release board at $40,000 per year. Mr. Chair, that brings us down to line 161, a small information technology request by the governor for the Ombudsman of Corrections is funded at $33,000 this biennium and $12,000 a year in ongoing funding. We included some other bills that had funding required outside of our area. On line 169, House File 42, use 4200, use of force training for the Office of Higher Education at $2.5 million per year. House File 3464, Clemency Board at $705,000 per year. On line 171, on line 172, House File 4174, felony murder, the aiding and abetting public defender costs of $600,000 one time in fiscal 2023. On House File 3702, a criminal enforcement increase at the Attorney General, that is $1.8 million a year ongoing. And on line 174, House File 1369, a prosecutor charging data task force. This is funding to the sentencing guidelines. It would be $117,000 in 23 and $121,000 in fiscal year 24. Mr. Chair, moving down to line 188, we transfer $10 million from the general fund to an opiate epidemic response fund. And on line 189, we transferred $7 million from MinCorp to the general fund. Mr. Chair, that is the main impacts to the general fund from the DE amendment. You can see on line 198, the total is $200 million in funding in fiscal 22-23 and $320 million in TAILS. We also have a couple of small impacts to special revenue funds. On line 203, we have a revenue loss from driver license reinstatement fees due to reduced penalties for marijuana. That is a loss of $14,000 a year to the driver and vehicle services funds. And on line 204, we have an increased county share of Red Wing per diem costs by counties, and that creates a special revenue fund at $2.6 million per year. And Mr. Chair, that is all of the fiscal provisions in the DE amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. We'll walk into the policy. Yeah, very well. So next we'll turn to Mr. Jackson and Mr. Gebo to take us through the policy provisions in the DE2.
Mr. Chair, Ben Johnson from House Research. I'll start walking through Article 2, 3, and 4. Mr. Chair, Article 2 begins on page 23. This article establishes and amends criminal penalties and includes policies that impact public safety. Section 1 makes changes to the Chapter 13 data provisions related to body-worn cameras and establishes timelines for law enforcement agencies to disclose body camera recordings of incidents involving the use of deadly force that result in death. Those need to be released to the decedent's family and legal representatives first, and then later to the public. Sections 2, 3, 8, and also 32 are from House File 2433. They require the Commissioners of Corrections and Public Safety and both the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and Post Board to prioritize public safety and human rights when implementing their missions and duties. Section 3, which is page 26, starts on line 11, is from House File 2433 as well. Section 4 is from the Department of Public Safety Policy Bill. This section modifies the requirement for county attorneys to provide victim notice in civil commitment proceedings to those victims who have submitted a written request to receive notice. Section 5 is a conforming change related to Section 4. Section 6 is from the same policy bill and clarifies that the Office of Justice Programs, not the Department of Corrections, is the designated agency responsible for domestic abuse funding. Section 7 is also from that policy bill and requires the commissioner to annually report to the legislature a list of reports that the commissioner is obligated to submit. It provides that if the legislature does not repeal or otherwise modify by law a reporting requirement, the commissioner must continue to provide each mandated report as required by law. Mr. Chair, this is slightly different from the version seen in committee that would have had those reports end if the legislature took no action. Section 8, which is page 29, line 29, is from House File 2433, and again is a duty to include public safety. This is on the Commissioner of Public Safety. Section 9 authorizes firefighters and qualified emergency medical service providers to participate in the state's soft body armor reimbursement program. This is from House File 2867 and includes a few changes. Currently, only peace officers are eligible to participate. This new language is limits the expansion to firefighters and qualified emergency medical services providers. Sections 10 through 12 are from the Department of Public Safety Policy Bill. Section 10 changes the name of the chemical assessment teams to hazardous materials response teams. Section 11 directs the Commissioner of Public Safety to consult with his or her agency when preparing the statewide hazardous materials incident response team. Section 12 removes an obsolete term. Section 13 is from House File 4200. This is on page 33 and begins at line 4. This particular section establishes a Public Safety Innovation Board within the Office of Justice Programs. The board's duties include monitoring trends in crime, identifying effective approaches to promoting public safety, and coordinating communications between communities, grant recipients, the department, and the legislature. This section has been modified slightly from the version last heard in committee in that it no longer requires the board to administer grants. It also reduces the frequency of the meetings from monthly to quarterly. Section 14, which is page 35, line 20, and also section 15 on page 36, line 10, are conforming changes related to changes of definitions in relation to labor trafficking. Section 16 creates a reward fund for information on missing and murdered Indigenous relatives. This is from House File 3055 and establishes a reward advisory group to make recommendations for payments of rewards from the fund and limits awards to no more than $1 million. That $1 million limit is new from the version that was heard in committee. Section 17 on page 38 establishes the Office for Missing and Murdered Black Women and Girls to collect data, facilitate research, and advocate for legislative actions to both address offenses against black women and girls and also address the underlying causes of those offenses. Section 18 is another portion of the Department of Public Safety Policy Bill. This section creates a questioned identity statute in Chapter 299C that codifies the BCA's questioned identity process that exists now. It details how a person can challenge data contained in BCA databases that is wrongfully associated with their name and the steps the BCA must take to disassociate wrongful information from a person's file. Section 19 on page 42 at line 18, and also sections 20 and 21, make changes to the access requirements for the Criminal Justice Data Communications Network and make changes to the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Advisory Group. Section 22, which is on page 45 at line 9, changes references to smoke detectors from smoke detectors to smoke alarms in statute. Section 23 is from House File 3955. It requires the Board of Private Detective and Protective Agent Services to accept proof of the required pre-assignment training from employees of licensed private detectives and protective agents if the training was provided by another Minnesota license holder within the past 3 years. It requires license holders to provide a certificate of pre-assignment training to employees even when the license holder paid for the training. Section 24, page 48, line 5, is from House File 2734. This section expands the list of qualified domestic violence-related offenses to include first-degree manslaughter, second-degree manslaughter, kidnapping, and false imprisonment. Sections 25 through 29 amend the definitions and crimes related to labor trafficking. Section 30, which is on page 50, starting at line 27, is from House File 3957. This section and Section 31, again, are from the Department of Public Safety Policy Bill. Section 30 defines the term data for purposes of the state's computer crime statutes. And Section 31 expands the list of computer-related criminal conduct to include the unauthorized use and retention of computer software and data. Section 33, which is on page, well, I skipped section 32. This is a provision that requires the post board to prioritize public safety and human rights. Section 33 is from House File 2910. This section permits law enforcement officers to attach a mobile tracking device to stolen vehicles without prior court approval if the owner of the vehicle either grants consent or reported to law enforcement that the vehicle was stolen. Section 34, which is page 53, line 21, is from House File 2815. It establishes that the statute of limitations for the crime of surreptitious intrusion is the later of 3 years from the date of offense or 3 years from when the offense was reported to law enforcement. This is the version that appeared as amended in committee. Section 35, 36, and 37 are again from the Department of Public Safety Policy Bill. Section 35 clarifies that the Office of Justice Programs, not the Department of Corrections, is the designated agency responsible for domestic abuse funding. Section 36 clarifies that the Office of Justice Programs and not the DOC is the designated agency, again, responsible for domestic abuse funding. And Section 37 removes an obsolete term. Section 38 is the Hometown Heroes Assistance Program from House File 2746. It contains edits to that program, which the legislature enacted in 2021 to provide services and financial support to firefighters. Section 39, which is on page 58, beginning at line 24, establishes a task force that includes professionals and youth to examine the juvenile justice system, identify underlying factors that contribute to delinquent behavior, and propose policies and legislative changes that both hold juveniles accountable and increase their connection with the community. Task force must submit its report by January 1st, 2024. Mr. Chair, this particular provision was not heard in committee and is new. Section 40 on page 61, beginning at line 9, is from House File 4200. This is the Emergency Community Safety Grant. This begins the list of grants from House File 4200. Sections 40 through 44 are those grants. The Emergency Community Safety Grants and Local Co-Responder Grants are sections 40 and 41. Those contain changes that require requests for proposal to be issued early and also require that awards be made on a first-come, first-served basis to qualifying applicants. The language is otherwise essentially identical to what was heard in committee. The following three grants, which are the Local Community Innovation Grants, Local Community Policing Grants, and Local Investigation Grants, all have some small modifications as well. They now include a final review panel that is made up of Office of Justice Program staff that will make award decisions. There have been a few other changes relating to the notification of eligible municipalities and tribal governments, the timing for issuing requests for proposal, and removes the provisions related to rulemaking authority. Mr. Chair, the final section in this article is on page 75, beginning at line 1. This section is a repealer from three different House files, House File 2770, House File 4078, and House File 3957. It repeals the crimes of sodomy, fornication, and adultery, also repeals the definition of blackmail, and deletes an obsolete term, which was Regional Hazardous Materials Response Team, from statute. Mr. Chair, I'm going to move on to Article 3, which I promise is significantly shorter than Article 2. Article 3 contains policies that are related to peace officers and the Post Board. The first section begins on page 75 at line 10. This is from House File 4200 as well. It permits rather than requires Post to order a law enforcement agency to conduct an inquiry into a written statement or complaint that alleges a violation of a statute or rule that the board is empowered to enforce. Sections 2 and 3 are from House File 717. These eliminate the statute of limitations in civil cases that involve an alleged sexual assault by a peace officer or an allegation that a peace officer caused a wrongful death of another. The sections also permit individuals who are not currently able to file suit due to the expiration of the limitations period to bring suit, provided they do so within 5 years. Section 4 is from House File 3785. This requires law enforcement agencies to use only scientifically content-validated job-related physical strength and agility screening exams for peace officer applicants. Section 5, which is on page 77, starting at line 26, is from House File 4200. directs the Post Board to adopt rules under Chapter 14 that permit Post to take action on a licensee for violation of a standard of conduct, whether or not criminal charges have been filed. Section 6 is also from House File 4200 and adds additional requirements that must be included in the body camera policies adopted by law enforcement agencies that have officers who use those body cameras. Section 7, also from House File 4200, it authorizes local units of government to establish civilian oversight councils and grant an oversight council authority to make findings of fact and impose discipline on officers. Section 8, which is on page 81, beginning at line 7, is from House File 1378. It provides that the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe has concurrent jurisdictional law enforcement authority with the local sheriff within the boundaries of their reservation, regardless of whether a cooperative agreement exists. Section 9 from House File 4200 is an amendment to the Peace Officer Training Assistance Philando Castile Memorial Training Fund that limits the use of those funds to training courses that are either involved in crisis response, conflict management, and cultural diversity, or autism training. Section 10 from House File 4200 establishes a task force to increase recruitment of new peace officers, increase the diversity of the racial makeup and professional background of licensed peace officers, promote education and training in community policing models, maintain high standards of education and training required for licensure, and make policy and funding recommendations to the legislature. Section 11 is the final section of this article. It is a title. It provides that the two provisions from House File 717 related to the statutes of limitations may be known as Justin Teagan's Law. Mr. Chair, that takes us to Article 4. Article 4 consists primarily of provisions from House File 1355. Sections 1 to 4 and also 5 to 20 are from that House file. It makes multiple changes to marijuana law, including adding some forms of non-flower marijuana to the definition of a small amount, creates a new gross misdemeanor offense for certain first-time offenders, provides for expungement for certain convictions, and also provides for restoration of the right to possess firearms following an expungement. Section 5 is from House File 883. That changes the definition of drug paraphernalia by eliminating products that are intended for testing the strength, effectiveness, or purity of a controlled substance. And Mr. Chair, I'm skipping forward to the final section, which is Section 21. This is on page 96. It starts at line 24. This is from House File 2958. This section establishes the task force on the abuse of controlled substances to review the ways in which the state's justice, social service, and health systems respond to substance abuse issues, examine approaches taken in other jurisdictions, and make policy and funding recommendations to the legislature. Mr. Chair, that completes the walkthrough of Articles 2, 3, and 4. I would ask that you recognize Mr. Diebel to continue with Article 5 and finish out the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Diebel.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Article 5 covers corrections and sentencing provisions. Sections 1 and 2 of Article 5 are from Representative Bond's Clean State Act. These, along with several other sections in the article, establish automatic expungement for certain offenses, including some misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors, as well as directing the BCA to identify eligible individuals for expungement and make technical changes. Sections 3 through 6 are from Representative Pinto's House File 947, which is relates to juvenile detention reform. Section 7 is from Chair Mariani's House File 3949, which directs that the governor may not terminate the ombudsperson for corrections without just cause. Section 8 is a new provision that was not in the previously heard bill, and this provides that counties must pay 100% of the cost of confinement of juveniles at Red Wing or for females committed to another facility. Currently, the rate is 65%. Directs that the additional 35% be deposited in a special revenue fund to provide grants to programs for preventative services and services to youth in both the juvenile justice and child welfare system. Sections 9 and 10 are Chair Mariani's Indeterminate Sentencing Release Board, which is a bill we heard last session. Section 11 is one piece of Representative Pinto's Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission staff reform bill, which, if you recall, it relates to putting the staff into the classified service. The sections 12 and 13 are two sections from Representative Long's House File 922, which relates to the juvenile hearings and detention. Section 14 and 15 are further provisions from Representative Pinto's juvenile detention bill that I previously mentioned. Sections 16 through 19 of Article 5 are further provisions from Representative Long's Clean Slate Act. Section 20 is Representative Pinto's, one piece of Representative Pinto's felony murder reform bill. Sections 21 through 26 are additional sections from Representative Long's Clean Slate Act. Jumping forward to sections 27 through 39. These are taken from Representative Long's House File 3464, which is his pardon and clemency reform bill. Section 39 creates a task force on the collection of charges and related data to identify data that should be collected and analyzed to determine ways in which individuals are charged and prosecuted in Minnesota. And this is House File 1369. Section 40 and 41 are the additional pieces of Representative Pinto's felony murder reform bill. Section 42 is the additional piece from Representative the chair's bill on sentencing guidelines reform, staff reform. And then the final section is a repealer that relates to the pardon board reform. Mr. Chair, that concludes my overview of Article 6, or Article 5. I'll move on to Article 6 and briefly cover that Article 6 is entitled Interstate Compacts, and this is comprised solely of Representative Moeller's House File 3308, which combines the State Advisory Council for the Interstate Compact for Juveniles with the Advisory Council on Interstate Adult Supervision. Jumping forward to Article 7, titled Community Supervision Reform. This is the bill we heard last Thursday in an informational basis, which is the department and the JRR's proposed reform to the community supervision system and funding model in the state. And so that's the entirety of Article 7. Mr. Chair, I don't have anything further to go through. That brings us to the end of the policy articles. I'm pending any of your questions.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Devo and Mr. Johnson. Members, we're going to then move to testimony. And first, we're going to begin with the Commissioner of Department. Oh, we're not doing this. Oh, I see. All right, very well. Okay, Commissioner Harrington, Department of Public Safety. Welcome, sir.
It feels funny being back here, I gotta admit. I'm used to you all being sort of in little boxes that move around occasionally, so, but I'm very happy to be here, sir. I agree.
Welcome, Commissioner. Please proceed.
Chairman Ioanni, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is John Harrington. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify today on House Public Safety Omnibus Bill, File 4608. As requested by the chair, I will try and make my comments brief, although I will admit, as a recovering member of the other body, that has been a challenge in my history. So, overall, this bill makes really incredibly strong investments in prevention, intervention, and enforcement. And really, those are the trio of things that really do work. Prevention is the most cost-effective method, and it's the method that most people would prefer, frankly. Most people would prefer not to have their house broken into or have their car taken or have themselves assaulted rather than have police catch the bad guy later on. They would rather just not have anything bad happen at the front end. And so we are very happy to see more money and more attention given to prevention. Intervention is, though, very, very important. And it's been a lot of my career has been spent working on intervention with young people. All too often, young people, whether they are have had their lives changed by abuse or trauma or drugs, they're in need of intervention, and their lives can be moved in a positive direction. And I've seen this happen over and over again, both when I do my work with gang members in the juvenile unit and later on working with Ujamaa Place, where we've taken young men coming out of correctional settings, and we've seen them literally with a 1% recidivism rate. We've seen them not re-offend. We've seen them not have contact with police, which we think is all very positive. And we have seen 80% of them get jobs and have housing and move their lives along so they can reconnect with their families. But there are people out there that are too dangerous and are not amenable to intervention and can't be prevented. And in those cases, targeted enforcement really does make the most sense. And I do emphasize targeted enforcement. This is not a broad sweep or a major sweep of people up. This is really picking out the worst of the worst, the bad guys that are out there that are bent on hurting other people who have shown by their past track record that they are not amenable to intervention and that even simple prevention is not likely to cause them to stop their crimes. We are pleased to see multi-agency, mutual aid and multi-agency emergency training included in this. This was a late add, and in answer to Representative Raleigh's question, I believe we have seen 240 individuals go through ICS 300 and 108 go through ICS 400 training. And I'm trying to get more data on where those folks have come so I can get you more particular data, but that is the most current number that I was able to get. I'm really excited about the First Responder Wellness Office. One of the things that we saw in the Deadly Force Working Group was one of those aha moments where both sides agreed, where the moms who had lost loved ones to Deadly Force and the chiefs of police that oversaw those folks both said that healthy cops make good decisions and make better decisions. And those are the kind of cops that we want out there. I would add, however, that this bill needs to not just be about police officers, because I can tell you that firefighters and EMS see things that they can't unsee also. And when they do, we need to have peer counseling and therapy and places for them to get treatment. Because, in fact, this is just good public policy. If we don't do that, they retire, whether it's under PTSD or something else tragic happens. If we help them get better, we retain their services and we retain the wisdom and experience that they bring to the profession. And so this First Responder Wellness Office really needs to be a broad approach that will affect all first responders. The General Crime and Trauma Recovery Funding, once again, we have communities that have experienced trauma. I'm looking at Representative O'Neill and thinking of her community most recently where tragedy has happened, and how do we help communities come back together after they've lost a loved one or they've lost many people, or as we've seen recently nationally where we've seen mass casualty events. How do we bring those communities back together? The BCA's Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement will help add to the credibility of one of the finest groups of investigators anywhere in the country. And I think it's just simply good practice for us to validate when people are doing good things. I mentioned recently the BCA cyber security upgrades. We have been working for 3 years to move this along, and at a time where I am getting bulletins almost on a daily basis from the NSA and from the President and from other national security agencies citing possible hacking, ransomware, and intrusions into a cybersecurity environment, this is good money well spent. The BCA is, in fact, the hub for every other law enforcement and criminal justice system in the state. If they get hacked, everybody effectively gets hacked. And so guaranteeing or moving us along so that we can make sure that their data is safe is good for privacy of the individuals, and it's good for the state also. Body-worn cameras, I have been saying for a long time, this is, in fact, an essential component of doing two things. It promotes respectful and ethical policing. At the same time, it allows chiefs of police to hold officers accountable when bad things happen. It provides a vehicle for greater trust, and that, I think, is a commodity that in our day and age may be in short supply, but it's a commodity that we need to build back towards. The local government emergency management grants are also essential. It was notable to me that not every county in the state has its own emergency manager. And yet each county has its own challenges, whether it's from natural disasters or others. And we call upon those individuals regularly to step up when bad things happen. And so this will bring us further along so that we have a much better coverage in cases of natural disaster. The crossover dual status youth model grants, once again, we have been emphasizing juvenile justice for the last several years. And I can tell you, looking at the crime stats, all too often I am seeing young people, 13, 14, 15 years of age, who are involved in serious crime. We need to do more to prevent them from getting involved in the system at the front end. But we also need to have those grants so that when they are in the system, we can help give them a direction out. The Prosecutor Training Fund, Nancy Haas isn't here, so I know she's not going to yell at me. But I'm happy to see it get moved along in this in any case. It will be a fund that will be managed by OJP. The overall investment in youth services, community crime prevention, intervention, and victim services, I think, is incredibly important. I am delighted to see the missing and murdered, and there's a new title on it now, so I'm not going to butcher that, the Missing and Murdered African-American Woman Representative Holland's Project moving forward. I can tell you from having taken reports on missing young African-American girls when I was in the juvenile unit at St. Paul, that those are tragedies, and that when their parents don't know what happened to those girls, it leaves a hole in their heart that you can't replace. This is the right counterpart to the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office, which is also just absolutely hitting the ground running with Julie Rudy now running that and meeting with folks all over the state. I want to thank you about the investment in the Office of Justice Program for additional staffing. I am a little concerned. One of the cliffs that we're facing is the VAWA funding, the Violence Against Women Act funding. It is funded by fine revenue that comes out of the federal system, and over the last couple of years, that fund has not been replenished as readily as possible. And so we're looking at a possible dramatic cut from our federal resources that fund so much of our domestic violence work. And so we had asked for some additional one-time funding to get us past that cliff. And so I would encourage you to look at that, because we do not want to see shelters and battered women and sexual violence centers not well-funded at a time when, quite honestly, I'm seeing those numbers go up, especially on the battered women side. I'm seeing those numbers go up in many, many cities. One city I talked to just recently, a third of their homicides are women. And the depictions of those homicides are so ugly that I won't mention them here. I think most of you know what I'm talking about. But we need to make sure that there's not a drop off there, because there are women out there that are isolated and alone and afraid. And these victim services, these advocates, are quite literally angels that go out to the houses and make the connection and give them that lifeline. So I would very encourage you to do that. We would also look at issues around housing, which is another critical area with domestic violence and sexual assault violence, is supportive housing so that when we do identify the victims, we have a place for them to go. I am very happy about the Public Innovation Board grants, and I will now move to an area where we got some funding, but I want to point out that I think there's an urgent need for you to look at full funding for this, and this is the BCA's violent crime approach. Why do I say it's urgent? Well, I'll give you an example from just one major city. Ag assaults in the preceding year, which were high, were at 1,678 this time last year. This year, they're at 2,083, an increase of 400 aggravated assaults in a three-month period. Domestic violence, as I mentioned, was at 172 the year before. They're at 243 thus far this year. That's a 70 increase over a three-month period. Carjackings, we've all heard a lot about them. They were at 102 this time last year. They're at 142, a 40 increase. And murder, while it has stayed flat at 18, that was a record year for this municipality. And to keep it in context, six of that 18 occurred in the month of March. Those are six Minnesotans that are not here anymore, and I think the urgency of the BCA's efforts to try and assist local municipalities in responding to violent crime are notable and necessary because many of these agencies are so short-staffed at this point that they're not going to be able to field the detectives and the cases and the workers that need to be used to be able to bring people to justice and to bring justice to these families. Our proposal was threefold: a violent crime support unit, which was in the BCA, and this is primarily forensic sciences. This is DNA and ballistics work. So this is, for those that are a little squeamish about, who we're going to hire with this, these are the scientists that will be able to bring the cases to court and prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. That they are absolutely essential as we are linking shell casings from cases in St. Paul to Minneapolis to Greater Minnesota and other places. Bringing those cases together allows us to hold offenders accountable. Analytical and operational support is also essential. Once again, these are the crime analysts. These are not the badge carrying folks, because frankly, I'll be honest with you, while I am very supportive of all the recruiting efforts we need to do, that's a 3-year out. It takes 2 years minimally to get your associate's degree and another 6 months to a year to get hired by a police department. And so the money we invest today for recruiting, while it's absolutely essential, means that in 2026, we'll see the first of those rookie cops hitting the streets. The analysts we can hire now, and that will drive us towards smart policing. That'll drive us towards finding the right people for the right crimes and putting the cases together. On some of these cases, and I will point to the Anaya case where the little girl was jumping on the trampoline at the BCA South, that took 100 search warrants for us to solve that case. That's 100 search warrants, and we couldn't have done that without the work of the analysts and the data scientists that helped us make that case. Finally, we are proposing a violent crime investigative partnership, and this is to bring together resources. In a world where nobody has enough, we're trying to partner together, and this would allow us to partner together with other local agencies, other federal agencies, the county agencies, to bring together a team of people so that we're in fact working in a team environment, especially on these cross-jurisdictional murder cases and violent crime cases. We really do believe that this is an urgent matter that we'd like you to look at and take serious consideration of. In closing, we are extremely happy to be here before you. We're extremely happy with the investments you're making in public safety in the state of Minnesota. We really do believe that you're taking the broad and holistic approach that will increase the level of safety, increase justice, and increase services for victims. And that is oftentimes, I think, the group that gets forgotten in the mix. The folks that are left behind, the folks that are sitting at the table with an empty chair, those are the folks that the Office of Justice Programs, members of the BCA, and the Department of Public Safety, we're here to talk about them also. And so I appreciate all of your attention, and I'll certainly simply stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. I do want to acknowledge the department's thoughtful approach as it brought forward its proposals for our consideration. Obviously, we didn't meet all of those, but we met quite a bit, which is a heck of a lot more than I can say for the other body, where virtually none of these provisions, thoughtful provisions, are included in their proposal at this time. So we have a lot of work ahead of us. This chair certainly will maintain an open mind, as I'm no doubt our committee will, continuing to interact with you and your people relative to these approaches. And we certainly call on the other body as we meet them to approach this similarly. So thank you for your testimony today. And if you can stick around, it'd be great.
I will absolutely. Thank you once again.
You're well. Next, we have the Commissioner of Corrections, Commissioner Schnell. Welcome, Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. It is truly a pleasure to be here. It is, as Commissioner Harrington mentioned, it's nice to see you all from this vantage point. So I want to thank you, Chair and members, for the opportunity to speak to this bill. My name is Paul Schnell, and I'm the Commissioner of Corrections here in Minnesota. We all know that this is a difficult time for public safety in our state. And we all see that, and in the midst of rising crime and associated political rhetoric that comes with it, I want to thank you for your thoughtful approach to putting together House File 4608. The bill is comprehensive and it invests in what works to keep Minnesota communities safe. While we must have effective and fair enforcement of our laws to hold those who offend accountable, we all know we cannot punish our way out of this increase in crime. We must be honest in admitting that simple answers to complex problems don't work, though they may make us feel a little better for the short term. But we will not be successful in achieving our safer community objective. For Minnesota's safety, we must take a long-term comprehensive approach to address the underlying causes of crime. And I was thinking about this earlier, just thinking back to 2019, now 3 years ago, where we were not having conversations about this, and what has happened in the meantime that led us to the place we are today in our state. So we have to address those underlying issues while at the same time taking effective and immediate steps to address the very real uptick in violence that we're experiencing. And I believe House File 4608 does this. It invests in communities across the state to deepen prevention efforts, ensure accountability, and it develops effective community-based interventions for those who engage in criminal activity, and you provide meaningful opportunity to meet the needs of Minnesotans who have been harmed by crime. In whole, I believe your bill advances our collective public safety. No doubt that we must double down to address violent crime and reoffending. And we have to be honest about the fact that the critical work does not end with arrest and prosecution. While imprisonment serves the state's retributive incapacitation and to a degree the deterrence objectives of the criminal justice system, we must not minimize the remaining objectives of rehabilitation and restoration. When 95% of people leaving our prisons return to neighborhoods and communities across our state, we must make sure that the objectives of rehabilitation and restoration are elevated, or there will be more victims. We must use the tools and practices that work, tools and practices that make us all safer. Mr. Chair and members, I'll speak briefly to a couple of those today. House File 4608 recognizes the historic collaboration and partnership of the counties, represented all three community supervision delivery systems to resolve a decades-old structural funding misalignment. This proposal, included in your bill, reflects the third-party analysis and outcome of the third-party analysis and research done by the Council on State Governments to ensure system-wide use of evidence-based practices. And as you all heard last Thursday in this committee, the changes will identify a permanent and transparent formula that grants money to counties regardless of their delivery system, and it includes tribal governments in the policy and finance change, a proposal that communities know best how to serve the needs of their people. And it creates the Supervision Standards Advisory Committee to develop uniform standards and definitions, identification of a standardized risk assessment tool that will be used to help guide case planning going forward. House File 4608 also includes a range of key investments that will help the Department of Corrections to more effectively carry out its mission. The proposed investments will help us to ensure safer communities for those leaving prison and re-entering their neighborhoods and communities by implementing a critical system upgrade to the DOC's antiquated and failing technology infrastructure, and creating a statewide supervision data hub to connect all partners in public safety. We appreciate the committee's continued interest in the safety of the state's prison, and your recognition of the need for this investment is recommended in the OLA's 2020 report. This technology infrastructure investment will make the DOC a more data-driven agency, and the benefits will be for policymakers, the state's criminal justice practitioners, members of the public, so that all better understand the corrections, the correctional outcomes, and there is a clearer sense of system accountability. The bill creates a family support unit within the Department of Corrections and invests in increasing family unity and connectedness during incarceration. There is funding for body-worn camera initiatives at the DOC for all corrections officers and ISR agents that increases transparency and helps keep our staff safe. It includes the Minnesota Rehabilitation Reinvestment Act, once again, supported by members on both sides of the aisle, and I want to thank you for your willingness to invest in this evidence-based bipartisan proposal that is enacted in some form in 38 other states, and doing this at a time when it is easiest, perhaps, to focus on increased one-size-fits-all responses to crime. Similar to last year, the bill includes creations of an indeterminate sentence review board that will ensure a panel of experts to conduct parole reviews and make those decisions. And we appreciate your investment in project management to help us coordinate and drive transformative work across all the divisions and service areas within the DOC. And finally, we thank you for supporting the department as we meet the rising cost of property insurance in our facilities. And finally, I would just note a couple of proposals that did not make it into the bill that we would encourage further consideration. The DOC requested creation of a reimbursement fund for transportation costs incurred by county sheriffs under the Interstate Compact for Adult Supervision. This fund would help counties, particularly those with small budgets, comply with federal rules. In turn, nationwide warrants would be issued in a timely manner, and the subject of those warrants transported and back returned back to Minnesota for disposition of the matters they face. The DOC also requested the creation of a one-time limited project, pilot project, at the DOC's mental health unit in the Oak Park Heights facility that would allow counties to place those people in their jails who suffer from serious and persistent mental illnesses. The mental health unit at Oak Park Heights has a specialized care, and we thought as a collective that this would be an opportunity to ensure that these individuals get the services and treatment that they need while they're oftentimes pending in jail for long, long periods of time. I also understand that lawmakers have difficult decisions when it comes to the various budget proposals that are before your committee. However, I must raise some concern about the use of the cash balance in the DOC's Correctional Industries Program, MNCOR. MNCOR is central to the DOC's efforts to provide opportunities for work readiness, training, and employment to those who are incarcerated. And it is statutorily mandated that MNCOR be financially self-sufficient. As such, depletion of $7 million from its reserves jeopardizes the long-term viability of MNCOR in a time when things are difficult from an industry standpoint. The department also has concerns over the increase and redirection of the county per diem payments for services to juveniles at our Red Wing facility. While we understand the intent, at a time when we're seeing an uptick in serious repeat youth offending, and the Red Wing facility sits with 30 open beds, it's important that we consider that resource availability. Red Wing is foremost a youth treatment facility operating in a secure setting. Red Wing is meant to meet the needs of youth involved in repeat serious offending. Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank you for all your thoughtful work and attention to our state's most pressing public safety needs, which you responded with a bill that focuses on both prevention and intervention, and I'm here to support it. I stand ready to answer any questions, Mr. Chair, you or the committee would have.
Thank you, Commissioner Schnell, and I will repeat what I shared with your colleague earlier. And I do thank you for acknowledging, actually more than that, for actually leading on the issue of, as I said earlier, putting the word corrections in, back into corrections, focusing on the important role that restoration and rehabilitation plays in the lives of individuals and those that they've harmed, as well as a positive impact on the nature of public safety in our state. This committee shares that that perspective with you. I do think it is, quite frankly, nothing, frankly, short of a tragedy that the other body, again, in the preparation of its response, has not incorporated those principles into what they put, what they're putting forward, and basically ignoring, in my opinion, so this is just me, ignoring what, quite frankly, is historic work. I don't know of any other time where three systems have come together the way they did in this state, and facilitated by a nationally renowned nonpartisan, evidence-based group to be able to do the kind of review that it did in proposing major reform for community supervision and probation approaches in our state that I think will not only be effective, but actually will be efficient use of state resources and will save us resources down the line, as well as save us pain and suffering in our state. And so, again, I would hope that the other body will do as this committee does, which is approach its work with an open mind and willingness to shift, adapt, change, and listen carefully to one another. So I thank you for your work. Members, we do have some extra time allotted to us, so let me just a couple of things. We have two people here who are physically present. I'm going to have them come forward, Mr. Butai and Mr. Bruce. I am going to invite. We have quite a list of folks on for Zoom testimony. I'm going to both apologize to them, but also invite them to come forward when we next meet on Thursday to offer their testimony at that time. And hopefully that that will work. My hope is that by doing this, I also can allow some time for our committee members to share some thoughts and ask some questions of our testifiers. So, Mr. Butai, if you can come forward, state your name for the record, give us your testimony. the chair would greatly appreciate.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members. My name is Elliot Butai. I'm the Criminal Justice Coordinator at NAMI, Minnesota. NAMI represents families and individuals that are impacted by mental illnesses, and we want to thank you for your intentionality in this committee of looking at a more holistic way to look at public safety. And I'm just going to go over a few of the items that we support. Starting with kind of first responders, law enforcement, we support the continued funding for training, for particularly for the mental illness crisis training for law enforcement, and the post-secondary funding to make sure officers are going into licensure with as much preparation as they can. We support the officer wellness programs and the Hometown Heroes program, agreeing with the commissioner that, you know, when our officers are well, we have more public safety. We also support the Minnesota HEALS program. It's important to intentionally address those traumas in communities, and we appreciate that that is a holistic approach that includes officers and communities. And we also support the innovations in community safety, and we, of course, have talked for several years now about the need for building up our crisis response system and partnering with law enforcement, and we're glad to see these funds go towards that. And we hope that cities and counties and organizations get those funds, that they will work to, you know, build our existing mental health system and work with what we know works. We also support the decriminalizing and lowering penalties for cannabis crimes. We know that those have disproportionately impacted Black and brown people and people with mental illnesses, and so lowering those to petty misdemeanors and allowing for expungements we think is a step in the right direction, and particularly given all the collateral consequences that people face as they enter the justice system. On the Department of Corrections, we're very supportive of the Family Support Unit and the funding for communicating with family members in prisons. We know there's research done by the National Institute of Justice that showed, this was research done in Minnesota, showed that when a prisoner was connected with a support person outside of prison, they were significantly, had lower risks for recidivism. And we know that connection and support is, you know, critical for people's mental health, people, the families, and the incarcerated people. We support the funding for supporting people as they're being released from prison to, and also to get an education while they're in prison, to be released on work release, to be supported in getting a job when they're leaving. And we also support the Native Women's Healing House, another important, you know, targeted thing that we really need to, I think, right some of the racial disparities in our state. We're supportive of the community supervision changes, the funding and the addressing that funding formula we know is difficult. Mental health and substance use disorder treatment are very often elements in community supervision, and so we're supportive of building that system up and helping people recover in the community. In 2019, we were also champions of the Ombuds, opening the Ombuds Office for Corrections, and we are supportive of the change to you know, make that only removable by just cause. I think it's a critical office and shouldn't be changed by a changing administration. And finally, on the corrections, we're also grateful for the inclusion of Representative Holland's bill to make phone calls free when they're to providers from jail. And I know I spoke to this committee before, and we talked about the $7 average for a 15-minute phone call from jail, and so we're grateful to see that inclusion. Finally, I just want to touch on some of the juvenile investments. We support all the investments for intervention, particularly the crossover model funding. You know, children in the child protective system and juvenile justice system, those are children with the highest needs, often with the most complex mental illnesses, and finding a place for them and to serve them is really critical. We support the conflict resolution centers and the youth intervention programs and the mental health services for juveniles. We also support the Juvenile Justice and Wellness Task Force, and I know that I think we're working on an amendment to include a mental health professional on that so that they can have the perspective from that, from our community on that task force. And finally, we're also supportive of the changes we know were brought up last year to ban strip searches, disciplinary room time in, and raise the age for detention of juveniles from 10 to 13. We know that children that go into the juvenile system enter with significant amounts of trauma, and we've heard from corrections officials and assisting research, you know, that these further traumatizing practices are not necessary. There are alternatives. There are safe alternatives from strip searches and putting children in solitary confinement, and so we support those changes as well. And that completes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Buttar. If you wouldn't mind, if you can just maybe take that chair off inside just so that if there are questions you might be able to answer quickly. The one in the corner over there. Terrific. Thank you. Mr. Devon, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Public Affairs Coordinator.
Mr. Bruce, not Mr. Devin.
Three first names. It's a blessing and a curse.
I've had two best friends who are Bruce over the years, and so I just default there. Welcome.
Appreciate it. I'm Devin Bruce. I'm the Public Affairs Coordinator for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, MAPE. We represent over 15,000 state professionals across all agencies, boards, and commissions. First of all, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for the invite and also for the work with Representative Moran, the DOC, representatives from MACAC and MACPO for working with us to address a lot of the concerns we had over the JRI language, specifically regarding benefit accruals for our agents who are transitioning from DOC or MACPO counties to CCA counties. We're currently working with them as well on some language around some salary protections, which ensures retirement benefits and those calculations. The work is quite ongoing in trying to address both equitable and sustainable solutions for funding formulas for our community supervision, regardless of geographic delivery systems, and we look forward to continuing that partnership and collaboration with the counties and with DOC and you as this bill moves through the process. We do have to highlight specifically the funding in this bill. It is significantly less than what the governor and the Senate and even the CSG work group recommended, particularly in fiscal year 23. If the goal is immediate and long-term reform for our community supervision system, then we must be prepared to fund both the immediate and long-term needs. One of our field service agents who was unable to join us today from Park Rapids sent this email to me last night, and I quote, "When I chose this career path as a teenager, I did not realize how much I would be asked to do with very limited resources, or how I constantly battle the feeling of needing to work more than 40 hours a week to ensure my clients are receiving the attention they need. The stress from heavy caseloads agents carry, on top of obligations from the courts and internal committees, is overwhelming. Funding for more agents will lead to better agents and better outcomes," end quote. Now, we hope as this bill progresses, we can find a little bit more additional funding for the immediate years as well as afterwards. Furthermore, if more money is not added to fiscal year 23, the implementation date for the funding formula needs to be changed, particularly pushed back until the money outlined in the budget tails is appropriate, or DLC will likely face significant cuts in funding to both staff. The first part of the funding formula that has it being implemented in funding year 23 also mandates that without being prorated, $250,000 to each county. So we're about $10 million short in this budget to even cover the cost. Secondly, we're also grateful for the additional staffing money for BCA violent crime reduction support and the BCA accreditation, and more money for cybersecurity upgrades and expansion for forensic testing. And finally, we would like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pinto for including the classification for our staff at the MSG the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. This will help address a lot of the uncertainty that comes with unclassified service and make sure that they have access to layoff rights and grievance protections that aren't normally available to unclassified folks. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. It's a good reminder in my mind that what we do is only as good as the people that are in it, the people that you represent a fine group of passionate, committed, and very skilled employees, and look forward to working with you to make sure that we're honoring that. Members, I'm going to open this up now. I have roughly, maybe not quite 15 minutes to work with, according to IT. So if there are particularly questions for any of the testifiers before us, this would be a good time for members to do that. And we're out of practice, you know. It's like, you know, we do it virtual hands up, you know, and I'm kind of like looking around like, no, you can actually physically raise a hand.
Mr. Mariani, this is John Bowen from Crow Wing County on behalf of AMEM.
Mr. Bowen.
Mr. Mariani, Mr. Chairman Mariani, are you there?
Mr. Bowen, I'm doing member questions at this point.
Okay.
All right, very well. Representative Levine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe Superintendent Evans may have left, but Commissioner Harrington is still here, and I just... Something that Commissioner Harrington said was really impactful, and that was about not funding the scientists, the DNA and ballistic scientists. And on my, so I'll ask you a quick question when you come. So I always take about 5 days or so a year off, and this time I decided to do a work vacation, and it was just all work. So I don't know if I'm going to do that again. But what I did do is I went up to Bemidji, and I saw your field laboratory up there because I wanted to see what was happening there. And it, Superintendent Evans met me, brought me through the whole thing, and we talked a lot about DNA and about the ballistics lab. And even then, he was saying how impactful that expansion would be. And he started telling me about the numbers and things like that. And I'm just wondering, I don't remember the exact numbers, but what was the ask and what was actually put in the bill? If you could answer that, Commissioner Harrington.
Commissioner Harrington.
Chair Mariani, Representative O'Neill. The ask was for $9.7 million for fiscal year 2023 and $9.1 million ongoing. The ask in regards to the lab is for two forensic scientists for DNA testing. That's $250,000 annually. A forensic science supervisor, 153 forensic scientists for the violence crime suppression unit, technicians, criminal intelligence analysts, training and continuing education. When you add up that, the space and the equipment, which is the, we need to get a new IBIS system or an updated IBIS system and the DNA supplies, that comes out to $2 million in fiscal 23 and $1.4 million in fiscal 24. That's the specific lab breakout of that particular ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, because I recall him saying you needed 42 FTEs, and most of that was scientists, and that just truncated, or just not, it emphasized to me how incredibly important it is, as you had said in your testimony, the scientists are really at the core of helping to solve all of these interconnected crimes. Not just in the metro, but all over the state. And the ballistics was really interesting. He would see shell casings from the metro, and then they would make their way all the way up to Bemidji and past. And so I just, you know, I love doing that kind of thing because it really helps me to wrap my head around what's really happening and how important those things are. So I was really surprised in your testimony to say that wasn't really funded much. Can you just explain how much is funded? So you asked for 9.7 million in 23 and 9.1 million going forward. And do you remember how much is actually in the bill, if anything, for the forensic scientists so we can solve the crimes that are happening right now?
For sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I believe that the total amount in the bill for all three entities was $1.5 million. So less than we needed for the forensics alone, and clearly less than we had looked for all three entities if we were going to do them in combination.
Mr. Representative Leo, we can ask Mr. Walz, too, to give us that number. Mr. Walz? May not have them right now, but that sounds about right.
Okay. Yeah. Can I ask one other?
Representative Leo, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other quick follow-up, since we do have the DOC commissioner come up, too, which I had a question for him as well. Thank you, Commissioner Harrington. Commissioner Schnell, you had really emphasized the fact that we're taking money from MnCorp, $7 million from MnCorp, and putting it into the general fund. And I've also spent a lot of time touring your prisons, and it's an interesting change to me because we're trying so hard to rehabilitate, and that really is part of the rehabilitative work that you're doing at each prison. What is the impact? You had just briefly mentioned it. You said it jeopardizes the future of MnCorp, which would be terrible because that's where so much job training is happening. What is the impact of the $7 million shift from MnCorp to the general fund? I don't know what the total budget is for MnCorp, so I don't know what that means in relation to your total budget.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, we generally try to keep about a 6-month reserve in that fund, and that is roughly about $10 million. Right now, that fund, the MnCorp fund, is right around $7 million, which is the amount of that would be moved. And the concern is that last month, as a for instance, MnCorp took a loss. And some of this is just dependent upon, you know, market issues that come up. Right now, there's tremendous challenges with getting product in for some of the companies that we do work for. And so that $1 million really was taken out of that fund balance in order to manage the MnCorp's cash flow needs, because we are statutory obligated to operate in the black.
Oh, okay.
Representative Leo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wow, that's a lot. So it's taking your entire fund balance. And I know it's been difficult through the pandemic, and you've had to shut it down, and you've had to kind of change what you're doing maybe in each facility because of that. Are you at risk of having to shut down MnCorp in some of the prisons so a lot of the job training would not happen if $7 million was taken out of your balance?
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, the risk is always, we certainly hope that we'll see a turnaround. That is always the goal. MnCorp has done an incredible job of being self-sustaining, covering the cost of its staff and many of the programs that we operate, not just the job training elements, but they cover some reentry and educational funding as well. And that is ongoing. But when things are outside of our control, pandemic-related issues, all those types of things, have really impaired the ability of MnCorp to maintain. And so we've had to use that fund balance quite regularly over the last 2 years.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Commissioner, as you know, MnCorp was in play last year and the year before as well. I don't think in the end we wound up using it. So let's see, maybe 3 years in a row here. Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I'm glad you're up there. You were talking about analysts, and I'm wondering how many do we have at the BCA now? And do they also exist, actually, at the Department of Public Safety?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, there are, I believe, in excess of 40 analysts currently. It depends on the operation. So there are analysts that work in crime analysis. That's a very small number. I believe that's around 14. There are other data scientists who would also be classified as analysts who work, for example, in CGIS and compute all of the data, for example, the crime reports and things on that. And that's where the bulk of them are currently. And the Department of Public Safety has a few analysts, primarily. We have analysts, I believe, in Homeland Security and Emergency Management, once again, are data scientists, and we have been looking for data analysts for OJP in order to be able to do a better job of computing victim statistics and reports there.
Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with the analyst, I think you made a really good point that adding officers is going to take us 3 years, and we have crime that is rising now. So I think that the approach in this bill is really to look at community investments, things like that. But in terms of training an analyst to get to work, how long do you think that would be, and how many did you request in terms of increasing for analysts?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, I can get you that information. I don't have a specific number right at the tip of my fingers. I wish Superintendent Evans hadn't been heading to another meeting, but I will get you that information. The train-up time for an analyst is significantly shorter than it is to, because in part we can get them from military service, we can get them from other business services, and in fact, one of our challenges is we've been losing analysts to local police departments who oftentimes pay significantly better for a significantly less work than we would task them with. So we have been able to train up many analysts at the BCA, but then we lose them. So there is a pool out there. The colleges produce them every year, and so that pool is not as reticent, I think, or will not be as delayed as trying to hire sworn officers who need to be post-certified.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Lee Johnson, and then we'll close out. I want to do a couple of housekeeping things, but this is the beginning of the conversation. We'll be having a long one on Thursday. Lee Johnson, please.
Chair Mariani, Commissioner Harrington, Commissioner Schell, thanks for being here today. It's good to see you in person. I just got a couple questions for Commissioner Schnell. I've talked to quite a few of the staff at a number of the prisons. I'm friends with many of them. I'm just wondering how the morale is with the staff right now in the prisons. I have some concerns. And just wondering if there's anything in this bill that'll help the morale, plus also in help stop some of the assaults on staff. I know that they've been up as well. I had a friend of mine that was assaulted here a couple weeks ago. Myself, thankfully, wasn't hurt seriously. But those are issues that we also need to deal with to make sure our staff are safe.
Mr. Chair, Lee Johnson, I would just say we concur that we have faced some really challenging times with management of the population. Our staffing, as being experienced by law enforcement, has been a profound challenge. While we have had significant numbers, over 150 corrections officers hired since January 1st alone, it has, we are seeing a massive shift. There are some facilities where we struggle more, and some of those more in the metro today. Rush City, Oak Park, and Stillwater are the places where we have been really the hardest to get additional staff. Although we have been doing immense levels of recruiting, we have recently convened. I think they met, in fact, today. Was the first meeting was a multidisciplinary group from within the DOC as well as some outside folks focused on responses to violence within the corrections facility. And that's responses to violence, both violence perpetrated by incarcerated persons on staff as well as incarcerated person on incarcerated person. And we really are looking at some of what are the causal factors. Right now we know that COVID has created pronounced and long-standing challenges for the population as well as our staff and staffing. For instance, we've had many of our incarcerated folks have been locked down for long, long periods of time. We have now started to enact policies, and we've met with staff to talk about this, that I think will open up to get people into recreation, to reduce some of the social distancing requirements that would allow more people to work in MnCorp. We all know that idleness really creates significant safety and security challenges, and that's one of the biggest factors. And hopefully, we don't see a resurgence here, and that we can maintain things and actually advance. And that's what our staff want to see happen. That's what the incarcerated population want to see happen, and that's
where we're really focused. I would also say that, you know, the body camera effort, we've looked at the research in some of the other states have shown, as was the case in law enforcement, that wearing body cameras in the correctional setting will reduce some of the challenges that come to and violence perpetrated by incarcerated folks against our officers, our staff, and we think that that's a pronounced value. One of the things we heard loud and clear from some of our staff was the fact that when there was assaults, the prosecutions were not as aggressive as they should be. Looking at the fourth degree assault statutes particularly, then we think body cameras, the better collection of that evidence up close and personal, the interaction that occurred is will make a big difference in the prosecution of those cases going forward. Those are just a few of the examples of things that we put in place.
Lee Johnson, and let me just say, members, before I forget, please, if you can put your materials back in the folder. This is an old practice that we haven't used for a couple of years. It really helps because it helps our staff then make sure that your folders are well prepared for you when we come back together on Thursday. I am pushing our IT folks here. Lee Johnson.
We have two more days to talk about this. I'm hoping that the commissioners will be here those days as well. So if issues pop up, we can ask them some questions.
Appreciate that, Lee Johnson. To both our commissioners, thank you for your testimony today, for your work and being with us. I do want to apologize again to those who are in Zoom. I'm hoping that you'll be able to join us on Thursday. We'll take it at the top of our meeting to make sure that we hear your voices at that time if you're able to do so. With that, thank you, Mr. Butai and Mr. Bruce. With that, members, this committee stands adjourned.